You're listening to Life in Deep Ellum's podcast.
Hey, friends. If you listened to the podcast last week, then you will remember that we had some recording issues. I had to jump in and read the second half of my sermon because the original file went corrupt. And that happened again. Yeah, we're having people look into it. Don't worry about it. We'll try and get this fixed, but because we're spending so much time trying to research these sermons on Revelation, we don't want them to disappear into the ether. I'm going to go ahead and just read the whole sermon that I preached last Sunday on Revelation, and that way there will be at least someone to potentially listen, hear, enjoy what we put together. All right, so here we go. This is our sixth week in the book of Revelation. We got two more to go. I had someone say to me the other day that Revelation has always been sort of like a black box. Like, no one knows what's inside the black box. Like, what's in the box? Brad Pitt style, what's in the box? And my friend said that because he felt like this series has been like helping him understand this mysterious book. And I hope, hopefully this has been helpful for you guys, opening up the black box for you. If not helpful, at least slightly entertaining. Well, this morning, I get to cover a well-known phrase that I would like us all to say together. Repeat after me, the Whore of Babylon. Yay! Feels good to say, right? My primary goal is, in covering these chapters, is not to blast the Roman Catholic Church, which is a popular perspective of the Protestants, nor is my goal to go on a rant about all the abominations we see in the supposed culture war that we are living in. No thank you. Not going to touch that with a 10-foot pole. What I really want to do is talk about worship. What is worship? In this world of pain and suffering and loss, why does worship matter? So consider the Niagara Falls, and unfortunately you guys aren't going to be able to see the pictures that I showed. But my grandparents used to have a cottage off the shore of Lake Ontario, just 45 minutes out of Niagara. So I have visited Niagara many times from a very young age. I've been on the famous Maid of the Mist, a boat that ventures into the roaring foam at the bottom of the falls. Everyone has to wear like slickers because the air itself is drenched. You can feel the reverberation in your ear canals. It's reverberating. You can feel it on your skin. The whole air seems to be shaking. And Niagara is a famous place where daredevils have tried to make a name for themselves. Mostly people would try to go over the falls in some sort of fortified barrel. A few of them survived, but usually with major injuries, and the ones who didn't survive all passed away. And in 1930... there's a guy named George Stathakis. He went over the barrel with his pet turtle, which was said to be 150 years old. The barrel, unfortunately, when it went over, got trapped behind the falls, and it took them a while to get the barrel out. And since the barrel only had so much air, when they retrieved it, George had suffocated. He didn't die from the impact, but from suffocation. Miraculously, the turtle survived. In 1990, a man named Jesse Sharp went over in a white water canoe. He knew how to handle rapids, so he was confident he could handle the Niagara Falls. He even made a reservation at a restaurant 4 miles downriver. He decided to not wear a helmet so cameras would recognize his face. He was very confident. And they found his kayak, and that's all. In 1995, a guy named Robert Overcracker rode a jet ski over the falls, illegally, mind you, in an attempt to bring awareness to homelessness, and they recovered his body the following day. Maybe you guys are following me. The Niagara Falls are powerful. They are natural, and they are dangerous. Yet, for some reasons, humans like to defy Niagara. My favorite story comes from 1960. A 7-year-old boy, Roger Woodward, accidentally fell from a boat upriver, and he survived. You see, he was in this boat with his sister and his grandfather, and the boat capsized, and people saw and ran to the rescue of his grandfather and his sister, but he was right in the middle of the river, and they couldn't get to him. This 7-year-old boy went over the falls. And he survived. The maid of the mist picked him up. He was shell-shocked, traumatized, but unharmed. A 7-year-old boy, no tricks, no stunts, just an unadulterated miracle. And it's not a perfect analogy. All analogies break down at some point, but I read these stories and I think, one, there are those who try to conquer God with exhibitions of ego, only to find the weight of God's judgment, or a word we'll get into later, wrath. And two, there are those who are swept up into God's power, helpless and vulnerable, only to find mercy, life. Wrath and mercy. On one hand, we have judgment, but on the other hand, we feel a compelling reason to worship God. And that can get a little disorienting, a little confusing. So allow me to give you kind of a peek behind the curtain. My intentions for my sermon, or as my friend from the Deep Ellum Brewing Company calls it, my performance. Joel, how was your performance the other day? I mean, both sermon, performance, tomato, tomato, both are true. Consider this a sort of table of contents. I want to start off with the text in Revelation, starting off in chapter 15 with worship. Then I'll move into judgment and wrath, which is chapter 16. And then I'll focus on idolatry, chapter 17 through 18. So worship, wrath, idolatry. But then I will reverse out of that mess with some application, and we'll talk about idolatry as it relates to the world. Then we'll talk about wrath as it relates. And lastly, we'll bookend with worship. It's sort of like a valley. We start at worship, go down from the mountaintop to wrath into the valley of idolatry, climbing back up with wrath, back up to worship. I thought I'd go ahead and give you a peek behind the curtain, you know, sort of like a DVD has a behind the scenes or a director's commentary. And that's my goal, right? My goal is I might fail completely in communicating this, but it happens. I don't hit a home run every week, guys. Sometimes I ground out the second. Nothing special. But to move on, I'm going to go ahead and read for you chapter 15. On Sunday, we actually had my buddy Matthew Clark read this for everyone. If you remember, Revelation was meant to be heard aloud. It was meant to be read in public settings and consumed not by private people trying to pick it apart and study it, but it was meant to be experienced, an apocalyptic book. So here's chapter 15. I saw in heaven another great and marvelous sign, seven angels with the seven last plagues, last because with them God's wrath is completed. And I saw what looked like a glass sea glowing with fire, and standing beside the sea, those who had been victorious over the beast and its image and over the number of its name. They held harps given them by God and sang the song of God's servant, Moses, and of the Lamb. Great and marvelous are your deeds, Lord God Almighty. Just and true are your ways, King of the nations. Who will not fear you, Lord, and bring glory to your name? For you alone are holy, and all nations will come and worship before you, for your righteous acts have been revealed. After this, I looked, and I saw in heaven the temple, that is the tabernacle of the covenant law, and it was opened. Out of the temple came the seven angels with the seven plagues. They were dressed in clean, shining linen and wore golden sashes around their chests. Then one of the four living creatures gave to the seven angels seven bowls made of gold filled with the wrath of God and who lives forever and ever. And the temple was filled with smoke from the glory of God and from his power, and no one could enter the temple until the seven plagues of the seven angels were completed. And so we kind of get this idea of worship. We see the victorious, those who didn't take the sign of the beast, and they're singing beside the glassy sea. And it's a crazy sight. It's like the cartoon How the Grinch Stole Christmas. Maybe you have seen that. Remember, after the Grinch stole all the presents, he's up in his mountaintop thinking that all the songs that he so detested would all stop. But then he hears the songs still singing from Whoville on Christmas Day. The singing wasn't connected to their presence or circumstances. It was something deeper. And that's what I think about in terms of the victorious by the glassy sea, singing their song. And so instead of a text poll, I'm going to ask you guys to consider just personally, What style of worship did you grow up with? You got three options here, or four. Formal liturgical is one. Is your worship kind of formal liturgical? Did you grow up with kind of charismatic slash emotional worship? Or like the middle of the road, were you like semi-reserved, or I'm going to call it Baptist-y? Like, you don't lift your hands all the way, it's kind of halfway. Or maybe your answer's none. I didn't grow up with any worship, and I think worship is weird. I know lots of people who think that. Of course, worship isn't just music. We can't even boil it down to artistic expression. You know, art is a very helpful tool for worship. It's kind of like you'll hear sometimes worship leaders say things like, let's welcome in the presence of God. Let's invite God's presence. But the truth is, God's presence is always there. It's kind of like a microscope. When you look through a microscope, you see bacteria. But the microscope didn't make the bacteria appear. The bacteria was always there. Such is the way with worship. God's presence is always there, but the arts, singing, music, poetry, they somehow open our eyes to the things we didn't see before. And I like how Eugene Peterson defines the worship, or the picture of worship at the Glassy Sea. He says, worship is the act of giving committed attention to the being and action of God. But worship doesn't make sense to some people. I mean, what difference does worship make really? And I'm serious when I say that. Christians should not be so quick to dismiss the questions of our skeptical friends, nor should we shame our Christian friends who have abandoned the spiritual practice of worship. For this, I turn to Eugene Peterson again. The people who quit worshiping are not, for the most part, people who do not care about the world, but precisely those who do. It is not for lack of moral energy that worship is slighted by many, but exactly because of it. They desert the place of worship with the best of motives in order to do something about the world's condition. So, on that challenging note, let's move forward into chapter 16. Let's talk about wrath, shall we? Right? So, in your lowest voice, say, the wrath of God. I'm going to read Revelation 16:1. Then I heard a loud voice from the temple saying to the seven angels, go, pour out the seven bowls of God's wrath on the earth. At this point, John's listeners would start to notice a pattern. In chapter 6, we got the seven seals. In chapters 8 and 9, we got the seven trumpets. And now, in chapter 16, we have the seven bowls. So seven seals, seven trumpets, and seven bowls. Now, I don't have time to go into it, but scholars will point to the similarities of these three sets of seven. And in other words, these aren't three separate events. This is what literary experts called recapitulation. It's John's way of describing the same event from three different perspectives. So the seven seals, we are seeing things from the perspective of the suffering church. In the seven trumpets, we're seeing things from the perspective of the unbelieving world. And in the seven bowls of wrath, we are seeing wrath from the perspective of the throne of God. Wrath and judgment are definitely not happy topics. Some churches love to talk about God's wrath and his desire to send unbelieving people to hell. Other churches are criticized for sidestepping God's wrath altogether, and they'll say these churches only want to talk about God's love and avoid talk of judgment. I'll give you guys one guess which one I've been criticized of doing. If my view of God is too loving for you, then I happily accept your criticism. Thank you very much. I honestly have no issue talking about judgment or wrath. I just have a theological responsibility to put them in the biblical context of God's loving character. Jesus is God revealed, and I'm not the only one who sees the necessity to detach from medieval perspectives of an angry God. Sadly, many people's idea of God looks way more like Zeus than Jesus. And that's a problem. So let me give you three points of context for understanding wrath. One, God's wrath stands against evil. It has a philosophical justification. Wrath is God's response to unrepentant evil. If God had no response, there would be questions. Wrath makes sense in that context. In this chapter, we see God's destruction of those who are destroying his creation. He stands against evil. Two, it is best to see wrath as consequences rather than God-initiated punishment. Think about the daredevils who tried to go over Niagara Falls. Many of them experienced God's wrath as they went over the natural consequences of how God made the world. It wasn't that they went over the falls and God smited them. They went up against God's power and experienced the consequences. God created the world so that evil could exist because we have free choice. But the Creator also baked wrath into His creation. And God's wrath, number three, is a response to those who suffer. All of these seals and trumpets and bowls are a response to the martyrs in chapter 16. The saints cry out, "How long? How long must we suffer? How long must we watch our oppressors continue their evil deeds without consequences? When will justice come? How long, O Lord?" All right, so time to move on. Let's talk about idolatry. Chapter 17. I'm going to read verses 1 through 6. "One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, 'Come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits by many waters. With her, the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries.' Then the angel carried me away into the spirit, into a wilderness. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had seven heads and ten horns. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet and was glittering with gold, precious stones, and pearls. She held a golden cup in her hand filled with abominable things and the filth of her adulteries. The name written on her forehead was a mystery: Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and of the abominations of the earth. I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of God's holy people and the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus. This is the whore of Babylon." You know, from this point on, John will spend quite a lot of time discussing two cities, Babylon and New Jerusalem. Clearly, these are metaphors for the kingdom of God, the kingdoms of this world. Now, on one hand, the harlot riding a beast is a symbol of Rome, like the Roman Empire. John says the seven heads are the seven hills, which is a reference to the city of Rome, which was nestled into seven hills. But notice the woman sits on a beast, the beast from a couple chapters ago, the beast of manipulated politics. So this woman is riding the beast of manipulated politics. Then we see later that the woman is devoured by the beast. Evil turns on evil. So while Rome is referenced, it's likely that John isn't just talking about the evils of Rome. He's also talking about the evils of all empires before him and after. Before John, Israel was in contention with Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, and Greece. Rome was just the most recent manifestation of empire. Later, we'd see empires like the Mongols, the Umayyad dynasty, Spain, Portugal, England, USSR, and America. Economists now speak of the BRIC countries, BRIC, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Who's the next powerhouse empire? The real point of this woman is that she is pictured as a harlot. Jerusalem is pictured as a bride, faithful to God. Babylon is pictured as a prostitute. In those days, this was understood through the eyes of seduction. There's something seductive about Babylon. Throughout the years, empires have followed the ways of Babylon, and many have been deceived, seduced. The harlot is a reference to the seductive nature of greed, power, oppression, ego. Another quote. This comes from the book Unveiling Empire, which was a reading of Revelation then and now. The authors say this: "Babylon exists wherever socio-political power coalesces into an entity that stands against the worship of Yahweh alone. New Jerusalem is found wherever the human community rejects the lies and violence of empire and places God at the center of its shared life." It's heavy stuff, but just remember, John is dealing with some heavy situations. People are dying. People are suffering, and there was no sign that anything would change anytime soon. Why have hope? Why believe? Why continue to worship? You know, as a pastor, John had to address a very difficult situation. So, okay, enough of this like negative Nancy talk, all right? We walked down the slope from worship to wrath to idolatry. We're in the valley. Now, here's where we did another text poll, but I'll let you guys think about it. I asked, which idolatry do you think is morally acceptable? I know it's a loaded question. Which idolatry do you think is most morally acceptable? Here are your options. Patriotism, materialism, activism, and sexualization. I'll read them again. Which one do you think is most morally acceptable? Patriotism, materialism, activism, or sexualization? It's a provocative question, right? Because the question assumes that each is a form of idolatry, but it's likely that each of you see these on a bit of a spectrum, that some of these you find very detestable, and others you're like, what's so wrong with that? So I want to just kind of walk through these, because the truth is each of them have light sides and shadow sides. Whenever you add ism to something, things get complicated. So one, we talked about patriotism. Nothing is wrong with loving your nation, right? I'm proud to be American, provided that doesn't also mean that I think I'm better than other nations or other people from other nations. Pride is great when it helps self-worth. Pride is not, is, you know, the enemy when it starts putting down other people. So patriotism doesn't mean not loving where you're from. What I'm talking about is this motto, think about it, God and country. Thought about that. Technically, anything either put alongside God as equal or higher is idolatry. God and country. It has idolatry baked into it. Materialism, too, is perhaps the easiest of us to swallow because it's all around us. And we all know that stuff can't save us, right? We have little sayings, you can't take it with you, or no one on their dying bed wishes they accumulated more things. But I'd say materialism might be the most sinister of these idolatries because it's just so subtle and it's baked into the air we breathe. Activism, it's an interesting one, right? On the light side, we have people fighting for justice and standing against evil. What's wrong with that? But on the shadow side, we have people putting all their hope in human effort rather than God. And God ends up being a distraction at best, or maybe even irrelevant. And when God is irrelevant, that's idolatry. Four, sexualization has a light side too. We all hopefully know how sexualization can lead to pain and suffering through unhealthy expressions. But the suppression of sexuality can also lead to similar kinds of pain and suffering. Our Puritan forebears left us with a lot of guilt and shame that we need to be set free of. But as I'm sure you've seen, getting free of that sometimes swings the pendulum the other direction a little too far. So idolatry, I say all that because idolatry is tricky. And the reason it's tricky and can slip in there, like good things become bad things, is because we were created to worship. Follow along with me here. Descartes, the Enlightenment philosopher, said, "I think, therefore I am." And since the Enlightenment, Western society has tended to view human beings as thinking beings. We are not. Our prefrontal cortexes do not define us. At the very core, we are fundamentally desiring creatures, not thinking beings, but desiring creatures. It's our desires that shape us, not our beliefs that happen in our brains. In other words, we don't become what we believe, we become what we worship. It's not our thoughts that shape us, but our desires that end up shaping us. The Great Whore of Babylon is a metaphor for worship gone wrong. So repeat this phrase, your kingdom come. Your kingdom come, it's a vital statement of Christian intentions. But the unspoken byproduct of this statement is equally important. When we say your kingdom come, we also must be willing to say other kingdoms go. All right, we've applied idolatry. Now let's apply some wrath. Let's circle back. Wrath stands against evil. It's more like natural consequences than God-initiated punishment, and it's a response to God's people crying out, "How long, O Lord?" Well, back in 2016, when five Dallas DPD were shot and killed, Rachel and I attended a special prayer service at Concord Church, one of the larger black churches in Dallas, and it was a powerful scene with black and white pastors from all over Dallas. Those of us who were ministers got to sit at the front, and we were all given an order of service with the minutes allotted for each speaker, total megachurch move. It was pretty funny to watch the intersection of church cultures. After a couple of black pastors spoke, the white preachers commented on how 5 minutes must mean something different in South Dallas. But it was pretty awesome how these pastors just bantered back and forth. And the music, oh, so good, so soulful. It felt like medicine to my aching heart. And the way everyone dressed, I mean, geez, I was easily the most underdressed person in this gigantic room, wearing my jeans, a short sleeve button up. Afterwards, I was lingering on stage and got talking with Kirk Franklin. If you don't know, he is a Grammy Award-winning musician, and he had helped with the music during that service, and he was dressed to the nines, three-piece suit, perfectly manicured hair, facial hair. His skin was like glowing. It was like all shiny. He and his wife, they looked like they just walked off the red carpet, and I was talking with him, and he gave me like a little look up and down, and you know what he said to me? He said, "Hey, man, I like your look." I was just like, I got complimented for my clothes. I guess if you get enough people in a room all dressed up, not dressing up is considered a bold fashion statement. Several black pastors spoke, and then some white pastors spoke. And this one white pastor of a large megachurch really put it out there. He talked about how he used to think racism wasn't an issue in America anymore, but after conversations with an African-American friend, he got re-educated. And I remember him saying that it is possible to be pro-black and pro-police at the same time. And when he said that, the place erupted. It was awesome. The pastor standing in front of me, whose earlier words literally cut me to the heart, he jumped up, spread his arms wide in appreciation. Everyone was just cheering. But afterwards, I was speaking with a girl I knew who worked hard in the areas of social justice, especially around prison reform. And I was smiling at her and asked her what she thought. And she smiled sadly and said, "I just don't think it will make much difference." And I knew where she was coming from. I had heard her frustrated comments about faith without works is dead. This is perhaps the hardest part of crying out, "How long?" God's justice can feel like it takes forever. But biblically, wrath is not our job. God tells us, "Vengeance is mine." The Old and New Testament take painstaking efforts to remind us that vengeance belongs to God. This says two things. One, it's not my job to even the scales, personally or on some societal level. But two, it says that God is not passive. Vengeance is His. He is actively working towards justice. And in some way, He asks us to cooperate with Him. It's a mysterious, blurry line between cooperating with God and trying to be God. Which leads us back up the hill to worship. Right where we started, a group of those redeemed by the Lamb, singing by the glassy sea, they sang, "Great and marvelous are your deeds, Lord God Almighty. Just and true are your ways, King of the nations." When I visited Sequoia National Park earlier this year, I got up early and went by and sat by General Sherman, the largest tree on the planet. It's about 275 feet tall, almost 40 feet wide. And get this, they guesstimate that it's about 2,700 years old. It's been here since before Jesus' time. So I sat down with my journal next to this ancient tree, and I imagine what it must have been like to be this tree. How much has the world changed since he was born? He grew up in this isolated mountain grove of sequoias. He survived many harsh winters, many forest fires. You could see the scorch marks. He must have been an old man the first time he saw a human. And now these humans have built trails and bring cameras to photograph him. And in my imagination, I was taken outside of myself. I was transported into something bigger than me. The tree inspired me to see the world in a new way. And my heart was opened to transcendence. This is what worship is for, guys. This is why we worship Jesus, the Son of God. By gazing at his goodness, we are transported into something bigger than ourselves. We begin to see the world in a new way, God's ways, and our hearts are opened. And that blurry line between cooperating with God and trying to be God becomes a little bit clearer through the act of worship. So, in my experience, there are two problematic ways people can respond to worship. One is they quit worship. They just let it go. This often comes from a response to the wear and tear of crying out, "How long?" I think about the Jewish theologians after World War II, and they have to wrestle with concentration camps. Is this a God we want to waste our time with anymore? How long, oh God? Most people haven't been through concentration camps, but that doesn't mean that their suffering isn't valid. So these weary believers come to a decision to quit worship. They think, fine, I'll do it myself. The reason this is problematic is because throughout history, the best intentions have often ended up using the same tools of empire, fighting Babylon's evils with Babylon's ways. It's problematic. But there's another response that's problematic. Some quit worship, but others subvert it. This comes from not sincerely engaging the question, how long? Worship doesn't challenge me because my life is pretty comfortable, and I prefer to worship God in a way that maintains that comfort. Subverted worship. This is sort of my story. You know, I have trauma and pain in my life, so I don't want to act like I don't understand suffering, but I didn't grow up with the hardships specific to immigrant families trying to adjust to a society that semi-tolerates them or even holds them with disdain. My dad didn't have to sit me down and warn me about being extra polite with authorities or when I'm walking down a street to make myself unthreatening because American society will see me as more dangerous because I'm a black male. I'm not a black male. I didn't get that conversation. In addition, I have never felt the societal pressure to be pretty or quiet because I'm a dude. I'm not a woman. What I'm saying is that my personal experience didn't really need to cry out, how long? God, I can't stand being a white male anymore. How long? The early Christians were experiencing persecution. That's why they cried out. I was safe and sound in my suburban church surrounded by comfort, which still has suffering, by the way. All right, there's still suffering in those environments. It's a more subtle form of it, but I was numb to it. And I learned to subvert worship. God was a safe God. He looked like me. And everyone else who was crying out how long, I just couldn't relate to them. But there's a third way. And I asked the band to lead us in a song, and perhaps you guys listening to this sermon can go look it up on Spotify or something. It's a song called "Is He Worthy?" There's several different artists who sing it. But it has a line in there, "Is he worthy? Who can open up the scroll?" It's a great song to lean into the cry of the martyrs, "How long, O Lord?" So this week, my encouragement to everyone is to reflect on this simple quote, the one I said earlier by Eugene Peterson. Worship is the act of giving committed attention to the being and action of God. So now to him who's able to keep you from falling, to present you before his glorious presence without fault and with great joy, to the only God our Savior be glory, power, majesty, and authority through Jesus Christ our Lord, both now and forevermore throughout all the ages. Blessings, guys. Thanks for listening. Much love.